People returned to their conversations, standing in clusters near the food. Ga held his side, then nodded.
"I think I will sit," he said.
And they took chairs at an empty table. Sun Moon observed every move the partygoers made, attempting, it seemed, to read their conversations by gestures only. A woman came their way alone. She wore a cautious look on her face, but she brought Ga a glass of water. She wasn't much older than Sun Moon, yet she had tremors, so the water kept coming over the rim. In her other hand was a cocktail plate stacked with shrimp. Ga took the glass and drank, though it hurt when the water went down. The woman pulled from her pocket a piece of waxed paper and began placing the shrimp in it.
"My husband," she said. "He is my age. He has such a good heart, that man. By heart, I mean he would have intervened in that spectacle we just witnessed. No, he couldn't stand to see someone get hurt without getting involved."
Ga watched her place the shrimp one at a time on the paper. He stared at their opaque white shells and black bead eyes. These were the blind, deep-water shrimp they'd risked their lives for aboard the Junma.
"I can't say my husband has any distinguishing features," she continued, "like a scar or a birthmark. He is a normal man, about 45 with hair going white."
Ga held his side in pain. Sun Moon, impatient, said,
"Please leave us." "Yes, yes,"
the woman said. She looked at Ga.
"Do you think you ever saw him in that place where you were?"
Ga set the glass down.
"In the place where I was?" he asked.
"There are rumors," the woman said. "People know where you came from."
"You confuse me with someone else," he told her. "I'm not a prisoner. I'm Commander Ga. I'm the Minister of Prison Mines."
"Please,"
the old woman said.
"I must have my husband back. I can't... There's no point without him. His name was..."
"Don't," Sun Moon said.
"Don't tell us his name."
She looked from Sun Moon to Ga.
"Is it true? I mean, have you heard there's a lobotomy prison?"
she asked. She held a shrimp in her shaking hand and it wriggled mindlessly.
"What?"
Ga asked.
"No,"
said Sun Moon.
"Stop! You've got to help me find him. I've heard all the men are given lobotomies when they enter. They work like zombies forever."
"No surgery is needed to make a man work like that," he told her. Sun Moon stood. She took Ga by the arm and led him away. They blended into the crowds, mingling near the food. Then the lighting dimmed and the band began to tune its instruments.
"What's happening?" he asked her.
She pointed to a yellow curtain that hung across a second-floor balcony.
"The dear leader will emerge there,"
she said, and took a step away.
"I must go talk to people about my movie. I must learn what happened to Comfort Woman."
A spotlight hit the yellow curtain, and instead of "We Shall Follow You Forever," the band began a rousing version of "The Ballad of Rokuto-san." The tenor began singing of Rokuto-san, the baby-faced giant from South Hamgyong, the farmer's boy who became the fighting king of Japan, the baby-faced giant who bested Sakuraba. Belt on his waist, all he longed for was home. His only desire, a hero's return to his sweet place of birth, Korea. But our champion was stolen and murdered, stabbed by the shame-faced Japanese. A Japanese knife, dripping with urine, brought the great Rokuto-san to his knees. Soon, the crowd joined in. They knew when to stomp their feet and double-clap. A throng of cheers rose when people heard the rolling, blast-proof doors open behind the curtain. And when the yellow parted, there stood a figure, short of stature, round-bellied, wearing a white dobok and a mask fashioned to resemble the big baby face of Rokuto-san. The crowd went wild. Here, the tiny taekwondo fighter made his way down the steps, on nimble feet, to run a victory lap through the crowd. He grabbed someone's cognac and swilled it through the hole in his mask. Then he made his way to Commander Ga, bowing with the utmost formality before assuming a taekwondo stance. Commander Ga didn't know what to do. The guests began forming a large, loose circle around himself and this short man with his fists high. A spotlight was suddenly on them. The little man bobbed up and down, then approached Ga quickly, within striking distance, before backing away. Ga looked around for Sun Moon, but all he could see were the bright lights. The tiny fighter danced up to Ga and performed a series of airstrikes and shadow kicks. Then, out of nowhere, the imp punched him. A quick, snapping shot to the throat. A cheer went up. People began singing along with the ballad. Ga grabbed his windpipe and bent over.
"Please, sir,"
he said. But the little man had moved to the edge of the circle, where he leaned against someone's wife to catch his breath and have another drink. Suddenly, the little man back-circled in for another shot. Should Ga block the punch? Try to reason with the man? Run? But it was too late. Ga felt knuckles rake his eye, and then his mouth was stinging and fat, and then his nose went electric. He felt the hot flush inside his head, and then the blood poured out his nose and back into his throat. Then little Rokuto-san did a dance for everyone's pleasure, such as the Russian sailors do when on night leave from their submarines. Ga's eyes had watered, and he couldn't see well. Yet again the small man came close. He connected with a left hook to Ga's body. Ga's pain responded on its own, sending a fist into the man's nose. You could hear the plastic mask crumple. He took a few stagger steps backward as blood trickled from the nostril holes, and a collective gasp went up from the assembled guests. They placed him in a chair, fetched a glass of water, and then lifted his mask to reveal not the dear leader, but a small man, weak-featured, disoriented. The spotlight lifted to the balcony. There, clapping, was the true dear leader.
"Did you think it was me?"
he called.
"Did you think that was me?"
The dear leader, Kim Jong-il, came down the stairs, laughing, shaking people's hands, and accepting congratulations for a prank well done. He stopped to check on the little man in the dobok, leaning in close to inspect his wounds.
"He is my driver,"
the dear leader said, and shook his head at the man's nose. But a pat on the back was in order, and the dear leader's personal physician was summoned. People grew quiet as the dear leader approached Commander Ga. Ga saw Sun Moon turn sideways to make her way closer, so she could hear.
"No, no,"
the dear leader said.
"You must stand up straight to stop the blood."
And despite the pain in his midsection, Ga straightened. Then the dear leader took hold of Ga's nose, pinched the nostrils shut above the bridge, and drew his fingers down to squeeze out all the blood and snot.
"Did you think it was me?"
he asked Ga. Ga nodded. "I thought it was you." The dear leader laughed and slung the mess off his hands.
"Do not worry," he said. "The nose is not broken."
A handkerchief was handed to the dear leader. He wiped his hands as he addressed his guests.
"He thought it was me,"
he announced to the delight of the room.
"But I am the real Kim Jong-il. I am the real me."
He pointed at his driver, whose eyes went suddenly wide.
"He is the imposter. He is the one who pretends. I am the real Kim Jong-il."
The dear leader folded the cloth and gave it to Ga for his nose. Then he lifted Ga's arm.
"And here is the real Commander Ga. He has beaten Kimura, and now he will defeat the Americans."
The dear leader's voice rose, as if he were speaking to all of Pyongyang, all of North Korea.
"In need of a real hero, I give you Commander Ga,"
he said.
"In need of a national defender, I give you Commander Ga. Let's hear it for the holder of the golden belt."
The applause was grand and sustained. Within it, the dear leader spoke to him in a low voice.
"Take a bow, Commander,"
he said. Hands at his sides, he bent at the waist, holding it a moment, observing drops of blood as they fell from his nose to the opera house carpet. When he rose, as if on cue, a small fleet of beautiful servants emerged with trays of champagne. Above, Doc Ho began singing Unsung Heroes, the theme song from Sun Moon's first starring role. Commander Ga looked to Sun Moon, and her face confirmed that she now understood that it didn't matter if her husband was alive or dead. He had been replaced, and she would never see him again. She turned, and he followed. He caught her at an empty table, where she took a seat amid other people's coats and bags.
"What about your movie?" he asked. "What did you find out?"
Her hands were shaking in front of her.
"There will be no movie," she said.
The sadness was pure on her face. It was the opposite of acting. She was going to cry. He tried to comfort her, but she wouldn't have it.
"Nothing like this has ever happened to me," Sun Moon said. "And now everything has gone wrong."
"Not everything," he said.
"Yes, everything," she said. "You just don't know the feeling. You don't know what it's like to lose a movie you worked on for a year. You've never lost all your friends or had your husband taken from you."
"Don't speak this way," he told her. "There's no need to talk like this."
"This is what hunger must feel like," she said. "This hollowness inside. This is what people must feel in Africa, where they have nothing to eat."
He was suddenly repulsed by her. "You want to know the flavor of hunger?" he demanded. From the table's floral centerpiece, he plucked a petal from a rose. He tore off its white base, then placed the petal to her lips. "Open," he said. And when she didn't, he was rough with the word. "Open," he demanded. She parted her lips and allowed the flower in. She looked up at him with welling eyes. And here the tears spilled as slowly, slowly, she began to chew.
"Citizens, come, gather round the loudspeakers in your kitchens and offices for the next installment of this year's Best North Korean Story. Have you missed an episode? They are available for playback in the Languages Lab of the Grand People's Study House. When last we saw the coward Commander Ga, he had been treated to his own Taekwondo demonstration by the dear leader. Don't be fooled by the commander's dashing uniform and cleanly parted hair. He's a tragic figure who has far, far to fall before talk of redemption can begin. For now, our dazzling couple was crossing Pyongyang late after an opulent party as neighborhood by neighborhood substation power switches were being thrown to cast our sweet city into slumber. Commander Ga drove, while Sun Moon leaned with the turns. 'I'm sorry about your movie,' he said. She didn't respond. Her head was turned toward the darkening buildings. He said, 'You can make another.' She dug through her purse and then in frustration closed it. 'My husband never let me run out of cigarettes, not once,' she said. 'He had some special hiding place for the cartons, and every morning there was a fresh peck under my pillow.' The Pyeongchang eating district extinguished as they drove through it, and then one, two, three, the housing blocks along Haebangsan Street went black. 'Nighty-night, Pyongyang. You earned it. No nation sleeps as North Korea sleeps. After lights out, there is a collective exhale as heads hit pillows across a million households. When the tireless generators wind down for the night and the red-hot turbines begin to cool, no lights glare on alone. No refrigerator buzzes dully through the dark. There is just eye-closing satisfaction and then deep, powerful dreams of work quarters fulfilled and the embrace of reunification. The American citizen, however, is wide awake. You should see a satellite photo of that confused nation at night. It's one grand swath of light, glaring with the sum of their idle, indolent evenings. Lazy and unmotivated, Americans stay up late, engaging in television, homosexuality, and even religion, anything to fill their selfish appetites.' The city was in full darkness as they drove by the Hokxin Line's Rekwan Station. Their headlights momentarily illuminated an eagle owl atop the subway's vent shaft, its beak at work on a fresh lamb. It would be easy, dear citizens, to feel for the poor lamb, plucked so young from life, or the mama sheep, all her love and labor for nothing, or even the eagle owl whose duty it is to live by devouring others. Yet this is a happy story, citizen. By the loss of the inattentive and disobedient lamb, the ones on other rooftops are made stronger. They began making their way up the hill, passing the central zoo, where the deer leader's own Siberian tigers were on display next to the pen that housed the zoo's six dogs, all gifts from the former king of Swaziland. The dogs were kept on a strict diet of soft tomatoes and kimchi to lessen that animal's inherent danger, though they will become meat eaters again when it comes time for the Americans to visit. In the headlights, they saw a man running from the zoo with an ostrich egg in his hands. Chasing him up the hill with flashlights were two watchmen. "Do you feel for the men hungry enough to steal?" Commander Guy asked as they drove by. "Or for the men who must hunt him down?" "Isn't it the bird who suffers?" Sun Moon asked. They passed the cemetery, which was dark, as was the fun fair, its gondola chairs hanging pure black against the blue-black sky. Only the botanical gardens were lighted. Here, even at night, work on the hybrid crop program continued, the precious seed vault protected from an American invasion by a grand electric fence. Gok glanced at a cone of moths, high in protein, circling in a security light, and he became melancholy as he drove slowly up this last stretch of dirt road. "This is a fine automobile," he said. "I will miss it." By this, the commander meant that, though our nation produces the finest vehicles in the world, life is transient and subject to hardships, which is the entire reason the dear leader has given us Juche philosophy. "I'll pass your sentiments along," Sun Moon said, "to the next man who finds himself driving it." Here, the good actress is agreeing that the car is not theirs, but rather is the property of the citizens of the Democratic People's Republic of Korea and the dearest general who leads us. She is wrong, however, to suggest that she does not belong to her husband, for a wife has certain obligations, and to these she is bound. Commander Ga pulled up before the house. The dust cloud that had been trailing them now caught up, ghostly in the headlights and the front door they illuminated. Sun Moon stared at this door with uncertainty, trepidation. "Is this a dream?" Sun Moon asked. "Tell me it's only a movie I'm in." "But enough of your moods, the two of you. It's time for sleep. Off to bed now." "Oh, Sun Moon, our heart never stops going out to you. Let us all repeat together. We miss you, Sun Moon." "Finally, citizens, a warning that tomorrow's installment contains an adult situation, so protect the ears of our littlest citizens as the actress Sun Moon decides whether she will open herself fully to her new husband, Commander Ga, as is required by law of a wife, or whether she will make a misguided declaration of chastity. Remember, female citizens, however admirable it may be to remain chaste to a missing husband, such a sense of duty is misplaced. Whenever a loved one disappears, there is bound to be a lingering hurt. The Americans have the saying, 'Time heals all wounds,' but this is not true. Experiments have shown that healing is hastened only by self-criticism sessions, the inspirational tracks of Kim Jong-il and replacement persons. So when the dear leader gives you a new husband, give yourself to him. Still, we love you, Sun Moon. Again, we love you, Sun Moon. Show your vigor, citizens. Repeat, we admire you, Sun Moon. Yes, citizens, that's better. Louder, we emulate your sacrifice, Sun Moon. Let the great leader Kim Il-sung himself hear you in heaven. All together, we will bathe in the blood of the Americans who came to our great nation to hurt you. But we get ahead of ourselves. That is for a future episode.
Home from the Dear Leader's party, Commander Goss studied Sun Moon's evening routine. First, she lit an oil lantern, the kind they place on the beaches of Jeju so night fishermen can navigate their skiffs. She let the dog inside, then checked the bedroom to see that the children were asleep. When she did, she left the doors open for the first time. Inside, by the glow of her lamp, he saw a low mattress and rolled oxhair mats. In the dark kitchen, he pulled a bottle of Roksong from the cool place under the sink. The beer was good, and the bottle soothed his stiffening hand. He didn't want to see what his face looked like. She inspected his knuckles, a little fan of yellow beginning to show. "I have nursed many broken hands," she said. "This is only a sprain." "You think that driver was okay? It looked like I broke his nose." She shrugged. "You have chosen to impersonate a man dedicated to violence," she said. "These things happen." "You've got it backward," he answered. "Your husband chose me." "Does it matter? You're him now, aren't you? Commander Ga Joljeon. Is that what I should call you? Look at how your children hide their eyes, how they're afraid to move. I don't want to be the man who taught them that." "Tell me then, what should I call you?"
He shook his head. Her face agreed it was a difficult problem. The lamp's light cast shadows that gave form to her body. She leaned against the counter and stared at the cabinets as if she were seeing the contents inside. But really she was looking the other way, into herself. "I know what you're thinking," he said.
"That woman," she said. "I haven't been able to get her out of my head."
He'd thought, by the look on her face, that she was somehow blaming herself for things, which was something the captain said his wife always did. But the moment she mentioned that woman, he knew exactly what Sun Moon was talking about. "That was foolish. That talk about lobotomies," he said. "There is no such prison. People start rumors like that out of fear, out of not knowing." He took a drink of beer. He opened and closed his jaw, moved it side to side to assess the damage to his face. Of course there was a zombie prison. He knew it must be true the second he'd heard it. He wished he could ask Mungnan about it. She'd know. She'd tell him all about the lobotomy factory. And she'd tell it in a way that made you certain you were the luckiest person in the world, that your lot in life was pure gold compared to others. "If you're worried about your husband, about what happened to him, I'll tell you the story."
"I don't want to talk about him," she said.
She bit one of her fingernails.
"You mustn't let me run out of cigarettes again. You must promise."
She retrieved a glass from the cupboard and set it on the counter.
"This is the time of evening when you pour me some rice wine," she told him. "That is one of your duties."
With the lamp, he went down into the tunnel to retrieve a bottle of rice wine, but he found himself looking at the DVDs instead. He ran his fingers along the movies, looking for one of hers, but there were no Korean films, and soon titles like Rambo, Moonstruck, and Raiders of the Lost Ark flipped the switch in his brain to read English, and he couldn't stop skimming the rows. Suddenly Sun Moon was by his side.
"You left me in the dark," she said. "You have a lot to learn about how to treat me."
"I was looking for one of your movies."
"Yes?"
"But there aren't any."
"Not one?"
She studied the rows of titles.
"All these movies he had, and not one by his own wife?"
she asked, confused. She pulled one off the shelf.
"What movie is this?"
Ga looked at the cover. "It's called Schindler's List." Schindler was a difficult word to say. She opened the case and looked at the DVD, how its surface shined against the light.
"These are stupid," she said. "Movies are the property of the people, not for a single person to hoard. If you'd like to see one of my films, go to the Moranbong Theater. They never stop playing there. You can see a Sun Moon film with peasant and Politburo alike."
"Have you seen any of these?"
"I told you," she said. "I'm a pure actress. These things would only corrupt me. I'm perhaps the only pure actress in the world."
She grabbed another movie and waved it at him.
How can people be artists when they act for money? Like the baboons in the zoo who dance at their tethers for heads of cabbage. I act for a nation, for an entire people.
She looked suddenly crestfallen.
The dear leader said I was going to act for the world. You know he gave me this name. In English, sun means he, and moon means dal. So I'd be night and day, light and dark, celestial body and its eternal satellite. The dear leader said that would make me mysterious to American audiences, that the intense symbolism would speak to them.
She stared at him.
But they don't watch my movies in America, do they?
He shook his head. No, he said. I don't believe they do. She returned Schindler's List to the shelf.
Get rid of these, she said. I don't want to see them again.
How did he watch them, your husband? He asked. You don't have a player. She shrugged. Did he have a laptop?
A what?
A computer that folds up.
Yes, she said. But I haven't seen it in a while.
Wherever the laptop is hiding, he told her, I bet your cigarettes are there too.
It's too late for wine, she said. Come, I will turn down the sheets.
The bed faced a large window that displayed the darkness of Pyongyang. She left the lamp burning on a side table. The children slept on a pallet at the foot, the dog between them. On the mantel above, out of the children's reach, was the can of peaches Comrade Byuk had given them. In the low light, they undressed, stripping to their undergarments. When they were under the sheets, Sun Moon spoke.
Here are the rules, she said. The first is that you will begin work on the tunnel, and you will not stop until there is a way out. I'm not getting trapped again.
He closed his eyes and listened to her demand. There was something pure and beautiful about it. If only more people in life said, "This is what I must have." She eyed him to make sure he was listening.
Next, the children will reveal their names to you only when they decide.
Agreed, he said. Far below, dogs began baying in the central zoo. Brando whimpered in his sleep.
And you cannot ever use taekwondo on them, she said. You will never make them prove their loyalty. You will never test them in any way.
She trained her eyes on him.
Tonight, you discovered that my husband's friends are happy to hurt you in public. It is still within my power to have one person crippled in this world.
From the botanical gardens, down the hill, came an intense blue flash that filled the room. There's no arc quite like a human meeting an electric fence. Sometimes, birds set off the fence in Prison 33. But a person, a deep humming blue snap, that was a light that came through your eyelids and a buzz that entered your bones. In his barracks, that light, that sound, woke him up every time, though Mongnan said, after a while, you stopped noticing. Are there other rules? He asked.
Only one, she said. You will never touch me.
In the dark, there was a long silence. He took a deep breath. One morning, they lined up all the miners, he said. There were about 600 of us. The warden approached. He had a black eye, a fresh one. There was a military officer with him, tall brimmed hat, lots of medals. This was your husband. He told the warden to have us all remove our shirts. He paused, waiting to see if Sun Moon would encourage the story or not. When she didn't speak, he went on. Your husband had an electronic device. He went down the rows of men, pointing it at their chests. When held up to most men, the box was silent. But for some, it made a staticky sound. This was what happened to me when he aimed the device at my lungs. It crackled. He asked me, What part of the mind do you work in?
I told him the new tier, down in the subfloor. He asked me, "Is it hot down there or cold?" I told him, "Hot." Ga turned to the warden. "That's enough proof, yes? From now on, all work will focus on that part of the mine. No more digging for nickel and tin." "Yes, Minister Ga," the warden said. It was only then that Commander Ga seemed to notice the tattoo on my chest. A disbelieving smile crossed his face. "Where did you get that?" he asked me. "At sea," I said. He reached out and held my shoulder so that he could get a good look at the tattoo over my heart. I hadn't bathed in almost a year, and I'll never forget the look of his white, buffed fingernails against my skin. "Do you know who I am?" he asked. I nodded. "Do you want to explain that tattoo to me?" All the choices that came to me seemed like bad ones. "It's pure patriotism," I finally said, "toward our nation's greatest treasure." God took some pleasure in that answer. "If you only knew," he told me. Then he turned to the warden. "Did you hear that?" Ga asked him. "I think I have discovered the only damn heterosexual in this whole prison." Ga took a closer look at me. He lifted my arm and noticed the burn marks from my pain training. "Yes," he said in recognition. Then he took hold of my other arm. He turned it so he could study the circle of scars. Intrigued, he said, "Something happened here." Then Commander Ga took a step back, and I could see his rear foot go light. I lifted my arm just in time to block a lightning-fast head kick. "That's what I was looking for," he said. By resetting his teeth, Commander Ga made a piercing whistle, and we could see that on the other side of the prison gate, Ga's driver opened the trunk to his Mercedes. The driver pulled something out of the trunk, and the guards opened the gate for him. He came our way, and whatever he had, it was extremely burdensome. "What's your name?" Ga asked me. "Wait, I don't need it. I'll know you by this." He touched my chest with a lone finger. He said to me, "Have you ever seen the warden set foot in the mine?" I looked at the warden, who glared at me. "No," I told Commander Ga. "The driver came to us carrying a large white stone. It must have weighed 25 kilos. "Take it," Commander Ga told the warden. "Lift it up so everyone can see it." And with much difficulty, the warden worked the stone up to his shoulder, where it perched bigger than his head. Commander Ga then pointed the detector at the stone, and we all heard the machine go wild, ticking with energy. Commander Ga said to me, "Look how it's white and chalky. This rock is all we care about now. Have you seen some rock like it in the mine?" I nodded. That made him smile. "The scientist said this was the right kind of mountain, that this stuff should be down there. Now I know it is." "What is it?" I asked him. "It's the future of North Korea," he said. "It's our fist down the Yankees' throat." Ga turned to the warden. "This inmate is now my eyes and ears around this place," he said. "I'll be back in a month, and nothing will happen to him in the meantime. You're to treat him how you'd treat me. Do you hear? Do you know what happened to the last warden of this prison? Do you know what I had done to him?" The warden said nothing. Commander Ga handed me the electronic machine. "I want to see a white mountain of this when I return," he said. "And if the warden sets this rock down, before I get back, you're to tell me. For nothing is he to let go of that rock, you hear? At dinner, that rock sits on his lap. When he sleeps, it rises and falls on his chest. When he takes a shit, the rock shits too." Ga pushed the warden, who stumbled to keep his balance under the load. Then Commander Ga made a fist. "Stop," Sun Moon said. "That's him. I recognize my husband." She was quiet a moment, as if digesting something. Then she turned to him in the bed, bridging the space between them. She lifted the sleeve of his nightshirt, fingered the ridges of the scars on his biceps.
She put her hand flat on his chest, spreading her fingers across the cotton.
"It's here?"
she asked.
"Is this the tattoo?"
"I'm not sure you want to see it."
"Why?"
"I'm afraid it will frighten you."
"It's okay," she said. "You can show me."
He pulled off his shirt, and she leaned close to observe in the low light this portrait of herself, forever fixed in ink. A woman whose eyes still burned with self-sacrifice and national fervor. She studied the image as it rose and fell on his chest.
"My husband. A month later, he came back to the prison, yes?"
"He did."
"And he tried to do something to you. Something bad, didn't he?"
He nodded. She said,
"But you were stronger."
He swallowed. "But I was stronger." She reached to him, her palm coming lightly to rest on his tattoo. Was it this image of the woman she once was that made her fingers tremble? Or did she feel for this man in her bed, who'd quietly started weeping for reasons she didn't understand?
I arrived home from Division 42 tonight to discover that my parents' vision had become so bad that I had to inform them night had fallen. I helped them to their cots, placed side by side near the stove, and once settled, they stared at the ceiling with their blank eyes. My father's eyes have gone white, but my mother's are clear and expressive, and I sometimes suspect that maybe her vision isn't as ruined as his. I lit a bedtime cigarette for my father. He smokes consoles. That's the kind of man he is. "Mother, father," I said, "I have to go out for a while." My father said, "May the everlasting wisdom of Kim Jong-il guide you." "Obey the curfew," my mother said. I had Comrade Pelk's wedding ring in my pocket. "Mother," I said, "can I ask you a question?" "Yes, son." "How come you never found a bride for me?" "Our first duty is to country," she said. "Then to leaders. Then to..." I know, I said. "Then to party, then to the charter of the workers' assembly, and so on. But I was in the youth brigade. I studied Juche idea at Kim Il-sung University. I did my duty. It's just that I have no wife." "You sound troubled," my father said. "Have you spoken to our housing block's Songun advisor?" I saw the fingers twitch on his right hand. When I was a boy, one of his gestures was to reach out with that hand to ruffle my hair. That's how he would reassure me when neighbors went away or we witnessed MPSS men pulling citizens off the subway. So I knew he was still in there, that despite the distemper of his patriotism, my father was still my father, even if he felt the need to hide his true self from everyone, even me. I blew out the candle. When I left, though, when I stepped out into the hall and closed the door and turned the lock, I didn't walk away. Quietly, I placed my ear to the door and listened. I wanted to know if they could be themselves, if they could let down their guard when they were finally alone in a dark and silent room and could speak as husband and wife. I stood like that a long time, but heard nothing. Outside on Shinju Street, even in the dark, I could see that troops of Juche girls had chalked the sidewalks and walls with revolutionary slogans. I heard a rumor that one night an entire troop fell into an unmarked construction pit on Tonggor Road. But who knows if that's true? I headed for the Rangwon-dong district, where long ago the Japanese built slums to house the most defiant Koreans. That's where there's an illegal night market at the base of the abandoned Rogyong Hotel. Even in the darkness, the outline of the hotel's rocket-shaped tower stands black against the stars. As I crossed the Pargor Bridge, pipes were dumping sewage from the backs of pastel housing blocks. like gray lily pads, shit-streaked pages of the Rodong Shinmun newspaper slowly spread across the water. The deals take place around the rusted elevator shafts. Guys on the ground floor arrange terms and then yell up the shaft to cohorts who deliver the goods. Medicines, ration books, electronics, travel passes, with buckets on ropes. A few guys didn't like the looks of me, but one was willing to talk. He was young, and his ear had been notched by MPSS agents who had picked him up for pirating before. I handed him Commander Gaw's phone. Real quick, he opened the back, pulled the battery, licked its contacts, then checked the number on the internal card. "This is good," he said. "What do you want for it?" "We're not selling it. We need a charger for it." "We?" "Me," I said. I showed him Comrade Pyok's ring. He laughed at the ring. "Unless you're selling the phone, get out of here." Several years ago, after an April 15th ceremony, the whole Pyubyok team got drunk, and I took the opportunity to lift one of their badges. It came in handy every now and then. I pulled it out now and let it gleam in the dark. "We need a phone charger," I said. "You want your other ear notched?" "Little young to be a Pyubyok, aren't you?" The kid was half my age. With my authority voice, I said, "Times change." "If you're Pyubyok," he said, "my arm would already be broke." "Pick the arm and I'll oblige," I said, but even I didn't believe me. "Let me see this," he said and took the badge. He studied its image of a floating wall, felt the weight of the silver, ran his thumb against the leather backing. "Okay, Pyubyok," he said. "I'll get your phone charger, but keep the ring." He flashed the badge at me. "I trade for this." The next morning, a pair of dump trucks pulled up and offloaded mounds of dirt on the sidewalks outside the glory of Mount Paekdi housing block, 29 Shinijuu Street. My work at Division 42 usually got me out of tasks like this. But not this time, the housing committee manager told me. Grass into meat was a citywide campaign. It was out of his hands. The manager was generally leery of me because I had had a few of the tenants sent away, and he thought I lived on the top floor out of paranoia rather than to protect my parents from some of the building's bad influences. I found myself in a two-day human chain that moved buckets and jerry cans and shopping bags filled with earth up the stairwell to the roof. Sometimes there was a voice in my head that narrated events as they unfolded, as if it were writing my biography as I was living it, as if the audience for such a life story was only me. But I rarely got the chance to put this voice to paper. By the end of the second day, when I got down to the first floor and found myself last in line to bathe in what was now cold, gray water, the voice had vanished. For my parents, I cooked spicy turnips with some mushrooms that an old widow on the second floor grew in kimchi jars. The power was spotty, so it seemed as though the amber light on the phone charger would never switch to green. My mother informed me that on the golf course, with the foreign minister of Burundi, Kim Jong-il had shot 11 holes in one. News of all the poverty in South Korea had my father depressed. The loudspeaker had broadcast a big story about starvation down there. "The dear leader is sending them aid," he told me. "I hope they can hang on until reunification." The mushrooms made my urine rusty pink. Now that the roof was covered with 20 centimeters of soil, all I could think about was getting back to Division 42 to see if Commander Gaw was on the road to recovery. "Not so fast," my housing block manager told me the next morning. He pointed off the edge of the roof to a truck full of goats below. Because my parents were infirm, I would have to do their share. Certainly a rope and pulley would have worked best. But not everybody around here went to Kim Il-sung University. Instead, We carried them over our shoulders, holding their legs out in front like handles. They'd fight like mad for about 10 floors, but then succumb to the darkness of the cement stairwell and finally lower their heads in closed-eyed resignation. Even though the goats appeared to be in a state of total submission, I could tell they were alert and alive because of what you couldn't see, what you could only feel against the back of your neck, their fast little hearts fluttering like mad. It would take weeks for the grass to grow, so a team was formed to make daily missions to Mansu Park to gather foliage for the goats to eat. The manager knew not to push his luck with me. We watched the goats warily circle the roof. One of the little ones got boxed against the ledge and was squeezed off. It was vocal all the way down, but the rest of the goats acted as if it never happened. I skipped my bath so I could race to the Yanggakdo market. It was shameful how little I got for Comrade Pyeok's ring. It seemed that everyone had a wedding ring for sale. Reeking of goat, I rode the subway home with a summer squash, some dried squid, a paper bag filled with Chinese peanuts, and a 5-kilo sack of rice. You can't help but notice how people on the metro have a way of giving you the stink eye without even glancing your way. I made a feast for my parents, and we were all in high spirits. I lit a second candle for the occasion. In the middle of dinner, the amber light on the charger turned green. I guess I'd imagined standing on the roof under the stars when I placed my first call with Commander Gaw's phone. Like I'd behold the whole universe as I first employed a device that could reach any person on Earth. Instead, I toyed with it while we ate, scrolling through the menus. The phone used the Roman alphabet, but I was only looking for numbers, and there was no record of calls coming in or going out. My father heard the tones that the buttons made. "Have you got something there?" he asked. "No," I told him. For a moment, it felt as though my mother glanced at the phone, but when I looked, she was staring straight ahead, savoring the fluffy white rice. Ration carts for rice had stopped months ago, and we had been living a long time on millet. They used to ask where I got the money for black market food, but they don't anymore. I leaned toward my mother. I held the phone up and slowly passed it back and forth before her eyes. If she perceived the phone, she showed no sign. I returned to the keypad. It wasn't that I didn't know anyone's phone number. I didn't. It was that only at this moment did I realize I had no one to call. There wasn't a woman, a colleague, or even a relative that I had to contact. Didn't I have a single friend? "Father," I said. He was eating the salty peanuts toasted with chilies that he loved. "Father, if you were to contact someone, anyone, who would it be?" "Why would I contact anyone?" he asked. "I have no need." "It's not need," I said. "It's want, like you would want to call a friend or a relative. Our party comrades fulfill all our needs," my mother said. "What about your aunt?" I asked my father. "Don't you have an aunt in the South?" My father's face was blank, expressionless. "We have no ties to that corrupt and capitalist nation," he said. "We denounce her," my mother said. "Hey, I'm not asking as a state interrogator," I told him. "I'm your son. This is just family talk." They ate in silence. I returned to the phone, moving through its functions, all of which seemed disabled. I dialed a couple of random numbers, but the phone wouldn't connect to the network, even though I could see the cellular tower from our window. I turned the volume up and down, but the ringer wouldn't sound. I tried to employ the little camera feature, but it refused to snap a photo. It looked like I would be selling the thing after all. Still, it irked me that I couldn't think of one person to call. I went through a mental list of all my professors, but my two favorites got sent to labor camps. It really hurt to add my signature to their writ of sedition, but I had a duty, and I was already an intern at Division 42 by then. "Hey, wait, I remember," I said. "When I was a boy, there was a couple. They would come over and the four of you would play cards late into the night. Aren't you curious what happened to them? Wouldn't you contact them if you could?" "I don't believe I've heard of these people," my father said. "I'm sure of it," I told him. "I remember them clearly." "No," he said. "You must be mistaken." "Father, it's me. There's no one else in the room. No one is listening." "Stop this dangerous talk," my mother said. "We've met with no one." "I'm not saying you met with anyone. The four of you would play cards after the factory closed. You would laugh and drink soju." I reached to take my father's hand, but the touch surprised him, and he recoiled. "Father, it's me, your son. Take my hand." "Do not question our loyalties," my father said. "Is this a test?" he asked me. He looked wide-eyed around the room. "Are we being tested?" he asked the air. There is a talk that every father has with his son in which he brings the child to understand that there are ways we must act, things we must say, but inside, we're still us. We're family. I was 8 when my father had this talk with me. We were under a tree on Moranbong Hill. He told me that there was a path set out for us. On it, we had to do everything the signs commanded and heed all the announcements along the way. Even if we walked this path side by side, he said we must act alone on the outside, while on the inside, we would be holding hands. On Sundays, the factories were closed so the air was clear, and I could imagine this path ahead stretching across the Taedong Valley, a path lined with willows and vaulted by singular white clouds moving as a group. We ate berry-flavored ices and listened to the sounds of old men at their changi boards and slapping cards in a spirited game of gostap. Soon, my thoughts were of toy sailboats, like the ones the Yangbang kids were playing with at the pond. But my father was still walking me down that path. My father said to me, "I denounce this boy for having a blue tongue." We laughed. I pointed at my father. "This citizen eats mustard." I had recently tried mustard root for the first time, and the look on my face made my parents laugh. Everything mustard was now funny to me. My father addressed an invisible authority in the air. "This boy has counter-revolutionary thoughts about mustard. He should be sent to a mustard seed farm to correct his mustardy thinking." "This dad eats pickle ice with mustard poop," I said. "That was a good one. Now take my hand," he told me. I put my small hand in his, and then his mouth became sharp with hate. He shouted, "I denounce this citizen as an imperialist puppet who should be remanded to stand trial for crimes against the state." His face was red, venomous. "I've witnessed him spew capitalist diatribes in an effort to poison our minds with his traitorous filth." The old men turned from their game to observe us. I was terrified, on the verge of crying. My father said, "See? My mouth said that. But my hand was holding yours. If your mother ever must say something like that to me, in order to protect the two of you, know that inside, she and I are holding hands. And if someday you must say something like that to me, I will know it's not really you. That's inside. Inside is where the son and the father will always be holding hands." He reached out and ruffled my hair. It was the middle of the night. I couldn't sleep. I tried to sleep, but I would just lie on my cot, puzzling over how Commander Ga had managed to change his life and become someone else, with no record of who he had been. How do you escape your party aptitude test score or elude 12 years of your teacher's rightness of thinking evaluations? I could sense that Ga's hidden history was chaptered with friends and adventures, and I was jealous of that. It didn't matter to me that he had probably killed the woman he loved. How had he found love itself? How had he pulled that off? And had love made him become someone else? Or, as I suspected, had love suddenly appeared once he took on a new identity? I suspected that Ga was the same person on the inside, but had a whole new exterior. I could respect that. But wouldn't the real change be if a person was to go all the way to get a new inner life? There wasn't even a file for this Commander Ga character. I only had Comrade Pyuk's. I would toss and turn for a while, wondering how Ga was so at peace. And then I would relight my candle and pore over Pyuk's file. I could tell my parents were awake, lying perfectly still, breathing evenly, listening to me as I rifled Comrade Pyuk's file for any insight into Ga's identity. I was jealous for the first time of the Pyuk, of their ability to get answers. And then, there came a single clear sound from the phone. Bing! It rang. I heard the creak of canvas as my parents stiffened in their cots. The phone on the table began to blink with a bright green light. I took the phone in my hands and opened it. On its little screen was an image, a photo of a sidewalk. And set in the pavement was a star, and in the star were two words in English, Ingrid and Bergman. It was daylight where this photo was taken. I turned again to Comrade Pyuk's file, looking for any images that might contain such a star. There were all the standard photos. His party commission, receiving his Kim Il-sung pin at 16, his oath of eternal affiliation. I flipped to the photo of his dead family, head thrown back, contorted on the floor, and yet so pure. The girls in their white dresses, the mother draping an arm over the older girls while holding the hand of the youngest. I felt a pang at the sight of her wedding ring. It must have been a hard time for them. Their father newly arrested, and here at some formal family moment without him, they succumbed to possibly carbon monoxide. It's hard to imagine losing a family, to have someone you love just disappear like that. I understood better now why Pyuk had warned us in the sump to be ready, to have a plan in place. I listened to the silence of my parents in that dark room, and I wondered if I shouldn't have a plan in place for when I lost one of them, if that's what Pyuk meant. Because Comrade Pyuk's family was clustered on the floor, the eye was naturally drawn there. For the first time I noticed that sitting on the table above them was a can of peaches, a small detail in relation to the entire photo. The can's jagged lid was bent back, and I understood then that the method Commander Ga would use to excuse himself from the rest of his biography, whenever he felt like it, was sitting on his bedside table. At Division 42, a strip of light was shining underneath the door to the Pyuk lounge. I slipped quietly past. With those guys, you never knew if they were staying late or arriving early. I found Commander Ga sleeping peacefully, but his can of peaches was gone. I shook him awake. "Where are the peaches?" I asked him. He rubbed his face, ran a hand through his hair. "Is it day or night?" he asked. "Night." He nodded. "Feels like night." "Peaches," I said. "Is that what you fed to the actress and her kids? Is that how you killed them?" God turned to his table.